Today on Wings, female circumcision in Sudan. The content may be triggering to some listeners.
Female circumcision has happened in different cultures and different societies across the world at different times, anything from the Aborigines, the American Indians, in Europe at some times in the Renaissance period. In the pharaonic history, we know that many of the mummies show circumcised women. So it's happened in different societies in different stages, probably connected to some historical clash between the view of women's sexuality and the need to curb that sexuality.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In 2020, the transitional government of Sudan outlawed female circumcision, also known as female genital mutilation or cutting. A recent report suggested 84% of women and 31% of girls in Sudan had been cut in this way. Wealthy families paid medical practitioners for the most extreme type. Dr. Nahid Tubia, a trained surgeon, works against FGM as the head of the Institute for Reproductive Health and Rights in Sudan. In 1992, when she worked at the Population Council in New York, she talked with UN Radio's Diane Bailey.
Dr. Tubia, what exactly is female circumcision, and who is circumcised?
To start with, I think the name circumcision is unfortunately a misnomer, because when we say circumcision, it gets equated with a male circumcision, which is basically removal of the foreskin of the penis. However, female circumcision is an excision, and it's an excision of part of the or the whole of the external genitals of girls and women. So male circumcision could mean different thing to different people. Some people would think about it as a very positive thing. A female circumcision is a mutilation, and it's not by any means the minor operation that it is in males. The different types, there are people who think that they should do it as a minimum level, which is just a clitoridectomy, excising the clitoris and stopping the bleeding either by pressure or by putting one stitch around the clitoris to stop the main artery. However, this tends to be the minority of cases, particularly in places like Sudan, where the circumcision is very common. In Sudan, it's about 80 to 90% of the population, at least of the north, east, and west, excluding southern Sudan, which is much more African, Christian, or do not relate to the northern culture. In the severe degree, which could be called infibulation, or you know, if people read about it, it would be called different things. Basically, it's cutting of the flesh, which would include the clitoris, and then mostly all the labia minora, and then the difference would be whether some or part or none of the labia majora gets cut. So it becomes almost semantics, because the effect is the same. The effect is that most of the sensitive tissue is removed. Having cut such extensive amount of tissue, there would be a lot of bleeding, so the stitching would be much more extensive, and therefore the scarring would be much more extensive. And what is left is an artificially made hole at the back of the scar, which is covering the hymen. So later in life, when women become sexually active, the problem of sexual intercourse is not only about defloration of hymen or whatever you want to call it, but also to widen this very tight ring of scar tissue and skin that's created artificially by the stitching.
So what age is a girl circumcised?
Again, that varies between country to country, but I'd say usually between the age of 4 to 8. Occasionally, in some countries, maybe even part of modernization, funnily enough, they started to reduce the age of circumcision, trying to do it at 1 year or 6 months in the hope that it will be less painful for the child, because although it seems like a horrific experience for the parents to subject their children or the girls to, they are parents and they do care for them, even though it seems to us that it's a mutilation. Some tribes do it just at the age of menarche, so 13, 14. Others who've adopted it later, historically, that is, can sometimes do it just before marriage, like 16, 17.
You're a doctor. What are the medical complications of this type of procedure?
The most immediate ones, of course, obviously, as any sensitive tissue in the body, part of the sensitivity of the tissue would be that it would have a lot of blood supply. And so the female genitals being very sensitive and also what we call spongy tissue, erectile tissue, which is usually filled with blood to become more turgid or erectile and sensitive, has a lot of blood supply. So the cutting can create a lot of bleeding. Of course, the stitching is then done to stop the bleeding, but in many cases, if the circumciser is not very skilled, then the bleeding can go out of hand and create either anemia if it's slow bleeding, but it could also be more dramatic and create shock, sometimes even death. The other thing is the infection, of course. A lot of these operations happen in rural areas by traditional birth attendants, by relatives, you know, older female relatives, or sometimes trained midwives. Very, very rarely by medical practitioners. So infection is very high. Of course, a lot of it probably passes untreated, unnoticed, and the body has, you know, fantastic powers of healing despite everything. But occasionally the infection would be very severe, again causing, you know, infective septicemic shock or gangrene or depending on the type of bacteria that gets into the wound. Also, immediately you can get urine retention. That's very common. The stitching is over the urethra, the outlet of the urine. And so you get pain, infection, and a scar on top of the urethra. So going to pass urine becomes very difficult. And the girls could not able to go to pass urine easily for 3, 4, 5 days, of course, which is damaging to the kidneys and puts pressure on the kidneys. And this, as I said, is much more commoner than the other types. You know, I mean, I would make a guess of about 50, 60, 70% would have some degree of urine retention until the pain and the swelling starts to subside. The later problems, of course, if you can imagine that you've just done extensive surgery in a very sensitive area, changing it from its original sensitivity to a very dull, hard scar tissue. And if we all feel the any scars we have in our bodies, we'll realize that their sensitivity is reduced and also their harder skin than the rest of our bodies. So this severe scarring can create several things. One of the things that does, and also we see this a lot in the hospitals in Sudan, is that some skin is trapped in the stitching. And so the glands that secrete the normal sweat and oils and lubricating material for the skin get embedded or buried inside the stitching. And instead of it getting to be secreted to the outside, it gets to become a big cyst. This is, on the one hand, a medical problem, but it's a huge psychological problem. I have seen personally, and I'm sure any doctor or gynecologist in countries where the severer forms of circumcision is performed will, you know, attest to seeing tens of these cases where women are walking around carrying anything from a lemon to a grapefruit size cyst or a swelling between their thighs and feeling very shy and very confused about it. They don't know what it is. They don't relate it to circumcision. They think they've got this monstrosity, you know. Are they becoming like men with penises? It's just, it creates huge problems, which means that they also don't seek medical advice. They don't want to know it. Sometimes they refuse marriage and refuse any exposure. I even suspect that some of them have had pathological, psychological problems from something as simple as what we call a dermoid cyst, which doesn't take 15 to 20 minutes to remove in a surgical setting, but it is a big problem. Menstrual retention also, because the flow of the menstruation is not left to be free, causes pelvic inflammatory disease. A lot of women used to come to me when I talked about circumcision and say that they really have very bad menstrual pain and congestion. And it's very difficult to say that it is related to circumcision, because a lot of women do have these symptoms. It would be interesting to study whether there is a difference in incidence between circumcised and uncircumcised women. But whether it's true or not, women do relate it to their circumcision. So psychologically, it's their way of rejecting what's happened by reflecting a lot of their symptoms on the circumcision. Menstrual retention can also cause, as I said, pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, either primary before they have the first child, but after each childbirth, women have to be opened, and then after the childbirth, they have to be stitched again, which means that, you know, they get repeat infections. And the incidence of infertility and secondary sterility is very high. And of course, for women in Africa, fertility is a very important social status. Difficulty of labor, as I explained just now, if a woman is tightly circumcised and stitched, unless you cut and decircumcise, the head would not be able to pass through the vaginal opening. So in places where there is no possibility of finding some medical or paramedical attended labor to open this scar, there would be an obstructed labor. And so when it's not attended by a midwife, it can create a very distressing condition, which is very common I think it's commonest in Sudan than anywhere else in the world, actually, which is called vaginal fistula. From the pressure of the head of the baby, an artificial tract is created between the vagina and the urinary bladder, and then there is no control over urine, basically. And a woman, for life, then starts dribbling urine, and that makes her, of course, smelly and a social outcast. And if you go to Khartoum Hospital, you'll find tens of women lying in the fistula ward, awaiting a very complicated, not very successful operation. A lot of them don't have any other home, so they just stay in the hospital. These are sort of the extreme, distressing complications of female circumcision. But fortunately or unfortunately, I can't decide, most cases would have either minor complications or none at all, because the body has fantastic ability to heal. So the medical problem is not seen amongst the population as a big thing. Their expectation for their own health is not very high. Their expectation of the health services is not very high. So people don't put such a big value on having a totally healthy life. They learn to live with pain, you know. Anything from untreated caries tooth, or, you know, repeated malaria or bilharzia, or, you know, infected wound ulcers because they walk in the fields barefoot. So having this extra complication, even if they related to the circumcision, it wouldn't feel strong enough to abolish something that they think is traditional and they ought to do. They grow up knowing that when you get to a certain age, you get circumcised. Your mother is circumcised, your aunts are circumcised, your friends, everybody's circumcised. And it happens at such an early age where, you know, the individual woman haven't developed the education or the knowledge or the know-how. Her mother could be in an age group where she might not have much say. So a mother who's maybe low-level education, say, may have questioned, why am I circumcising my girl? But she has a very little relative power in the social structure. Then comes someone like the grandmother, and that, I think, is a very, very interesting phenomenon. The grandmother is an honorary man. I think that's a phenomenon in many traditional societies. A woman has no power when she's born, but she gains sort of credit points. Marriage gains you certain credit points. Having children gains extra points. Having male children gives you even extra points. And then by the time you become a grandmother, probably by 45 or maybe younger sometimes, then you have another status. You are allowed to be a gatekeeper, what I call it, assigned to police the women's quarters. I mean, I'm using these metaphors. I hope people don't take them for the literal meaning. But then women are allowed to do things that they're not allowed otherwise. You know, they can smoke, they can drink, they can go out uncovered, they can do all sorts of things once they become grandmothers. And in return for these extra privileges, then they have to keep the tradition and the culture. And that's why if you go and ask most people who actually insists on the circumcision, it's the grandmothers. To them, keeping the status quo, now that they have benefited from the system, is very important. So when we say who perpetuated, why is it kept, we have to understand the dynamics of power within a society. Many young or modern educated men would say, you know, it's none of our business, you know, we don't know anything about it. It's these women do it to each other. It might be true at some level that they don't know exactly when it's happening or how it's happening. They don't take part in the actual ceremony, although they pay for it. They pay for the operator, they pay for the festivities and the food and drink and singers and everything that happens. So they do know. But most important is that they don't really need to follow up everything. They've delegated it. You know, they've delegated the keeping of the culture to these older women, so they need not have that direct guilty conscience about perpetuating it. But I think, in effect, in a male society, they are. I suspect personally it has to do with the image of the strength of women's sexuality in Africa. If we read the history and some early anthropological studies, women's sexuality in Africa was seen as very positive and strong, very, very unlike the European sort of model of the timid woman who should negate her sexuality.
Speaking of the whole issue of sexuality, does it impair a woman's capacity to enjoy sex, and does it make sexual intercourse painful for her?
Yes, unfortunately, the way that society views it, they think it stops women's sexual desire and maybe mechanically make intercourse more difficult. Of course, we all know it wouldn't do nothing to sexual desire because it's only cutting of the genitals, while desire is arises from other parts of us, from our brains mostly. But when it comes to actually fulfilling that desire, yes, it makes it much more difficult. I mean, the external genitals are designed for the fulfillment of enjoyment. Of course, there are other secondary areas of sensitivities, whether it's the breasts or the lips or, you know, anywhere else in the body. And we know that women's sexuality is much more complex than male, and it's not only concentrated on the clitoris. However, the clitoris and the labia are specialized organs. So it's like saying how people can function without their vision. They have an image of objects, but they don't see them. I think that's the closest I can bring it to, because the specialized organ is removed. It also, I think, accounts for a lot of sexual frustration in women when they are infibulated or even clitoridectomized.
The Egyptian writer Nawal al-Sadawi says amputation of the clitoris and sometimes even of the external genital organs goes hand in hand with brainwashing of girls, with a calculated, merciless campaign to paralyze their capacity to think and to judge and to understand. That I was quite impressed by that. Is that what you're talking about right now, the whole issue of preventing women from seeing?
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, women get wrapped up in their need to define themselves as female within whatever social definitions of female that happens to be in their particular society, whether it be African, Latin American, Asian, or European. There is a certain society-defined attributes to femaleness which women try to abide by or, you know, strive to belong to. And that seems to just take away from their rationality until they get a certain amount of consciousness, but also consciousness that has to be, unfortunate for many women in developing countries, that has to be joined with a lot of economic and political power. Otherwise, it would be a frustrated consciousness.
Now, you mentioned a BBC film on female circumcision. What sorts of things did you hear from the people in the Sudan as a reaction to the film?
The film took the BBC documentary style of a testimony. Most of the speakers in the film were women from Sudan, either speaking for the experience of what it felt to them to be circumcised, their memories, their pains, what it meant to health workers who deal with the complications and what do they feel about it, combined with trying to explain why it's still going on in Sudan. The film was really adopted at a very high scale by the community in Sudan. Although it was never shown on television stations, it entered almost, I would say, at least 50-60% of homes who have videos, which is also quite a lot, actually, by the way, because people have videos even when they don't have electricity sometimes. I think the reason people adopted it is because first it was showing women from their own society talking about it, and that gave it credibility. But it also showed that there was a lot of interest and anxiety about the issue, that men and women were very concerned with it. They just never had a reason or a focus or a chance to talk about it. So the film was a sort of a starting point. It became a way of opening up the subject. And the groups who kept asking for meetings to discuss it started at a level of university students. Every possible aggregation of university group, you know, from the psychological society to Islamic fundamentalist groups within the universities to women's groups, they started coming together and saying, hey, let's discuss this issue. What does it mean to us? Then some community organized women's activities like literacy training, skills training centers started asking to be shown the film and wanted to discuss what the issue meant to them. Some village activists also asked us to go to some villages and talk to the village community, which could be anything from the village leaders to the religious chief, to the elders, to men and women, down to the children. Everybody was there. It was quite an exciting experience to see that, contrary to what's commonly perceived, that, you know, people are not going to want to talk about this. Yes, there was a silence, and there was a strong conspiracy of silence around the issue for many years, but I think it's because a lot of the intellectuals, predominantly men, decided that it was too sensitive to discuss, while society was changing, meanwhile. And society has reached a point where, like, almost by popular demand, the issue was discussed. I remember the first time the female circumcision film was shown, it was shown at the Khartoum University Center for Development Studies. And there was a group of women and men from the university, basically, or intellectuals and educated people. And after the film was shown, some of the men, the university lecturers, got up and said, this is appalling, you know, how dare the British go around taking films about something that's very Sudanese, that's very private. How dare they show, you know, the private parts of our own women, you know, this is not acceptable. And besides, this is, you know, an internal issue, you know, they shouldn't be dealing with things like that. Especially the language and the ferocity with which some of these men just immediately reacted to the film. They thought it was a sort of cultural scandal. And you would have thought the women would have been very sort of subdued by this. But immediately they had such a reaction from such a range of women. It was quite exciting, actually. Some of the women just got up and in uncontrolled, I'm sure it wasn't a premeditated response or anger, it's just an anger that just came out from seeing this film and from men reacting like that. They just got up and said, the hell you talking about a cultural scandal, you know, these are our bodies. We have been mutilated, we have been hurt. You want us to keep silent about it. I don't care whether it's the British who are talking about it, and I don't care whether it's international agencies who talk about it. Why weren't you ashamed when it happened? Why aren't you ashamed when it's happening every day? Now you're going to tell me it's a shame, cultural shame, that this is being shown on television. I don't care about your cultural shame. I care about my body. And this is the kind of anger that came out. A very experienced old midwife was just livid. I mean, she just got up and was screaming at the top of her voice saying, don't tell me men have got nothing to do with it. I have been a midwife all these years. Men, they are the ones who come and knock my door and pay the money to do it. I had done it many times in my life when I didn't know better. I stopped doing it since I found out what it was like. But don't tell me men have got nothing to do with it. I know who's behind it. In my practice, I used to get the other side of it because I got to be known as sort of an advocate for women, and particularly in the area of sex and sexuality. I used to get a lot of couples. I became sort of like the honeymoon doctor. And they would come to me because they've been trying to consummate the marriage and they haven't been able to. They don't know what to do, whether they'd have an operation to open up a bit, or, you know, whether it was something wrong with them. So I end up being sort of a sexual counselor for newlyweds. And one of the things I used to do is to ask the man to leave and for me to discuss the issue with the woman a little bit. And what I found is that there is total rejection and fear and negation of sex and sexuality from the part of women. They just don't want to deal with it. They don't want to know about it. And they would just plead with me to find reason to tell these men that they can't have sex. So there's, it's so internalized, the pain they've already had and the potential pain, that they'd rather have life, go through life without sex. That would be such a relief. And they just don't want to deal with that part of their body. And I think that's, it's just very sad. And there's very little you can do about it.
You say it's in certain people's interest to keep the practice going. If you were to argue with, let's say, men and maybe the grandmothers, whom you call gatekeepers, what sort of arguments would you use to them that it's in everyone's interest that it be stopped?
That's a very good question. I think for the men, I would try and sift through society and, you know, even within men, they're not just one block of view, you know, there are the young and there are the more liberal. And as we know, many women's causes were helped by sympathetic men. So always finding the sympathetic men that will fight the cause would be something very important, who by nature just will adopt causes like that. But also for the majority of men to see it in their interest to have a mutually satisfying sexual relationship with their wife is something that could be of interest to them. And I think a lot of men are starting to see it like that. That even their image of sexuality and what is excitement is not about, you know, sleeping with a woman who has a very tight hole, which is a very Sudanese, by the way, image of what's pleasurable for a man. And that's why the recircumcision. But that actually, that there is a lot of excitement, just sexual education, bringing studies from other cultures, from other societies, just what we know up to now about both male and female sexuality, that there's a lot of interest and excitement to develop the personal aspects, the gentler, the caring, the mutual excitement of sexuality, which I think a lot of men would respond, or some of them anyway, would respond to that. As for the grandmother's issue, I'm not sure we can do very much about that. At least we can bring the argument that it's a loss of suffering for women they care for. We can also, again, bring the breaking of marriages argument, which, you know, they would be very worried about breaking of marriage. And if you can try and convince them that it contributes at least a lot of breaking in marriages, especially in modern times, you know, now that men want women more sexually active and things have changed, you know, and by circumcising, you are now acting against the social change and it's against the interest of your own kin sort of thing. Maybe we'll get somewhere, but I would say, well, let's put least effort on them. They're a bit of a lost cause.
Is there anything that you might like to add before we end?
I think it's very important to not see women as absolute victims, because women are dynamic in society, and of course they don't hold the power in society. But even within the African context, women are gaining power. And what I'm saying is solidarity would reflect itself in giving every possible support for women groups within these societies to handle the issue in whatever way they think is appropriate.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tubia.
Dr. Naheed Tubia spoke to Diane Bailey of UN Radio in 1992. 28 years later, the transitional government of Sudan has outlawed female circumcision. Dr. Tubia now directs the Institute for Reproductive Health and Rights in Sudan. She advocates for medical services for women and bodily autonomy for all. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, host of maternalgifteconomyrising.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.